Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Thank you for listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm Duncan MacLeod. I'm on an internet call today with Roger Hislop, Senior Research Engineer at Internet Solutions, to talk about a potentially very exciting new or newish telecommunications technology that makes use of the gaps in television broadcasts. It's called TV white spaces, and it can be used to deliver internet access at lower cost. It could, in theory, allow ISPs to cut the cost of communication, especially in underserviced areas in South Africa. Roger, you're an expert on this subject, so thanks so much for talking to Tech Central today.
It's my pleasure. The timing is just perfect because we've finally got regulations for TV white space use in South Africa.
Great. Well, we'll talk about those regulations, I think, in some detail during this discussion today. Roger, first of all, for the benefit of our readers and for me, what exactly is TV white spaces? How does it work?
Okay. So if you think of your probably your old TV set when you used to kind of twiddle a dial to get the channel you wanted tuned in the gaps between the channels, there was that white kind of white and black snow, and that's the white spaces. Everywhere where there isn't a TV channel, there's a space where potentially you could put other broadcasts, or you could put possibly a broadband wireless network. The problem is that you need to have a broadband wireless network in the TV white spaces without interfering with the other users of that spectrum, namely the people watching their favorite soapies. And so in principle, it's very easy to do. In practice, you need to be able to allocate a white space to a particular user in a way that doesn't cause interference with the primary user. And that's kind of the fundamental thinking behind TV white spaces, is that you've got a primary user. In South Africa, it would be the SABC or some of the other stations, which are being broadcast by Sentech as the sort of national signal distributor on their behalf. In other countries, you'd have a multitude of different signal distributors. So you need to make sure that the potentially broadband network signal that you're putting in these white spaces doesn't cause a problem for other users. And in the specific case of TV white space technology, that's done using something called a geolocation database. And essentially, it's a lookup where a white space base station calls home to this database and says, my location is these GPS coordinates. What channel can I use? And then the white space database will then do a lookup, and it's got a whole model in its back end, which has got a list of all of the different TV transmitters, all of their powers, the height of the transmitter, the elevation, and it works out a propagation model of where that transmitter is illuminating. And anywhere where it's not illuminating, it will then basically go, these channels are free, you can use them. And then if there's a problem, if somebody phones ICASA and says, I'm having a problem with my TV station, and they go and check, the white space database can then also tell the white space base station to move to another channel. Or if there's some kind of national emergency and they need to free up all the channels for possibly emergency services radios, they can kick off any of the secondary users so that those channels can be freed up. And that's in a nutshell how the technology works. And it's a very desirable technology because the TV bands, through a mixture of good luck and chance, are the perfect wavelengths to use for radio broadcast. Because if you go down lower in the frequency band, you've got problems with bouncing off the ionosphere, you've got problems that you've got to have a very big antenna, et cetera, et cetera. As you go up the frequency bands, you start to have a problem with radio energy being absorbed by water vapor in the atmosphere. You start to have much more expensive electronics because of the higher frequencies, et cetera, et cetera. So the band where the TV station sits, particularly the UHF band, where most of the TV stations sit, are technically perfect for doing radio communications, which is why it's so interesting to the broadband networking space, because the potential to roll out a network at a cost that's a fraction of what the other network technologies cost could fundamentally change the cost to communicate in South Africa and everywhere else in the world, particularly developing countries where we don't have as many radio stations or TV stations as maybe the developed world. I mean, we've got 5, 10, 15 stations. In the US, they'll have hundreds of stations. So for a developing country, the TV white spaces are an incredible opportunity to kind of bridge the digital divide.
Okay, you mentioned UHF spectrum, but which bands are we talking about? Which actual frequencies are we talking about here? From where
to where? So it's 694 to potentially 790, which is the entire frequency band. In South Africa, they're only going to use the lower band, which is essentially 694 up to.
Carry on. I have a phone ringing in the background, but please carry on.
Okay, no, we'll ignore it. So in South Africa, basically, you're looking at the entire band is 470 to 790. In South Africa, we're looking at 470 to 694. And then there's a tiny little bit that's been carved out because there's some old radio astronomy stuff. But fundamentally, it's 694 to 470 to 694 megahertz.
Okay, so we've supposed to have finished our digital migration project already, and the digital so-called digital dividend bands, which I think sit around 700-800 megahertz, are already supposed to have been reassigned to cellular companies to offer mobile broadband. Sorry, Roger, let me switch that phone off. I'll be with you in 1 second. Apologies about that.
So, yes, and that's interesting because the bands that ICASA has set aside is that lower range. So obviously with the digital migration, the TV stations that are currently in the upper range from sort of 700 to 790 are all being migrated to the digital multiplexes, mm-hmm. and the old analog transmitters are being turned off, which will then free up that band for reassignments to other uses. So if the allocations are then provided for a mobile phone or some other kind of networks, it'll probably be some kind of license basis. The 470 to 694 will have the TV stations that are still going to be broadcasting on the digital multiplexes, and then they will be able to be used on a secondary basis by sort of light licensed operators.
Okay. So once the digital dividend bands have been allocated for mobile broadband, can those bands still be used for TV white spaces, or will they be exclusively then used by licensed telecommunications operators?
Well, the way the regulations have been published is that TV white spaces are only going to be allowed in that 470 to 694 megahertz. But there is no technical reason why you couldn't use white spaces anywhere. And there's maybe a distinction that should be drawn between the different kinds of white spaces. So in the TV white space case, the broadband networks would be between the radio stations. Mm. So you're almost kind of interleaving them between other users. And that could also be done where there's maybe little sections of network or of spectrum which aren't being used in the other bands. You could also find that you could use white spaces on a sort of a geographic basis. So if you've got mobile operators that are providing services in KwaZulu-Natal but aren't providing services in the Northern Cape, you could potentially look at those as sort of geographic white spaces. There's also the possibility of white spaces on sort of a time interleaved mechanism where if an operator can operate in certain hours or certain minutes of the hours, that there'd be other minutes which would then be freed up. So there's no reason that you can't use white spaces in any frequency band. So in the US, there's been a big move to free up the 3.6 gigahertz band for white spaces. And there's a technology called CBRS, Citizens Broadband Radio Service, I think it is. And CBRS sits in that 3.6 gigahertz band, which is normally used by maritime, particularly naval radar. So yes, in principle, there's no reason why you couldn't use white spaces in any of the allocations. It's simply a matter of the regulator applying its mind to the cost benefit of what they could get in spectrum license fees for an exclusive use versus a potentially a primary and a secondary use band.
Okay. So if this technology is rolled out commercially in South Africa, first of all, what are some of the barriers to adoption? I presume that your average cell phone isn't going to be able to pick up these signals. You'd need some sort of a specialist receiving device. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah.
And related to that, what sort of speeds is this technology capable of? Are we looking at 4G type speeds or faster?
No, it's broadband, sort of old school broadband. So there's two technologies which are probably the most prominent. They're both IEEE standards. One's called 802.22, which is known as Wi-Fi. And the other one is 802.11AF.
Okay.
And the other one is 802.11AF. Sorry. 802.22 is Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi.
And then 802.11AF is Wi-Fi. So 802.11AF is very, very similar to Wi-Fi. It's basically a very similar MAC definition. But it operates in the sub-gigahertz space, and it allows for primary and secondary use. 802.11AF is much more suitable for distribution to end users. So it's much more similar to Wi-Fi. You put up an access point, and it can reach a few hundred meters. Or if you're using a directional antenna, maybe a few kilometers. 802.22 or Wi-Fi is much more suitable for backhaul links. And I think it's probably the most interesting from a cost to communicate point of view, because it's what they call the middle mile that generally costs the most when you're trying to reach an underserviced area. So it's very easy to set up a Wi-Fi access network in a village or a location. And once you've connected to a fiber node, it's very cheap and easy to get that traffic out to the internet. The difficulty is connecting that fiber node with that access point. And that's where something like 802.22 is really, really suitable, because you're getting speeds of sort of 30 megabits per second on one 8 megahertz channel. And the 8 megahertz channel is that's just kind of aligned with the old TV channel sort of divisions. And then if you bond a number of those channels, you can get 30, 60, 90, 120, maybe the low few hundred megahertz. Sorry, megabits per second. and that's a lot of bandwidth for an underserviced area. If you think of – so I did a kind of back-of-the-envelope calculation. And if you take a contention ratio of something like 20 to 1, you can give – 600 customers a 1 megabit per second uncapped account using just one of those 8 megahertz channels at a cost of around 25 rand per month.
Wow.
If you've got access to high sites and the sort of the backhaul network, because the propagation characteristics are really good, you can get sort of tens of kilometers. So that middle mile, which is maybe 10, 20, 30, 40 kilometers, can be covered very easily with a very low-cost radio. And you're not paying license fees. And the technology is relatively simple to implement. It's not technically complex. Somebody with a bit of technical capability can set it up. So when you're talking about speeds, you're talking in the tens of megabits per second, maybe to the hundreds of megabits per second, but over quite long distances. And then, obviously, this is first-generation type equipment. So over the next 2, 3, 4 generations, you're going to find that those speeds will double or triple or quadruple. And then you can start to get sectorization, so you can have multiple sectors reaching out to multiple users. So it's in terms of solving the cost of bandwidth in South Africa in underserviced areas, TV white space could be a huge game changer.
So you're not going to have to build thousands and thousands of towers to cover a large area. You could, in theory, put up maybe 20 or 30 towers in rural KwaZulu-Natal and cover the whole region, right?
Yes, and potentially you could do it where a small entrepreneurial startup gets involved that needed a massive amount of money to do a network build. So where if you're rolling out a mobile network, the equipment is intrinsically incredibly expensive. So mm-hmm. you're looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars for a base station. Whereas a white space network, I mean, the kit you can get from manufacturers like Carlson, they're based in the US. There's Adaptrum, there's Six Harmonics. They all kind of startup type of companies, but you're looking at probably in the region of $600 for a radio. And they're not very power hungry. So they're probably a couple hundred milliwatts, which means that you can easily put a base station up in a remote area and solar power it. So the barrier to entry is quite low, and the ability for an entirely new generation of network service providers to enter the space is now very, very real. And the only thing that was stopping it until now was the fact that there was no regulations in place, mm-hmm. which obviously has now changed since ICASA published its final regulations in at the end of March. So it's a very exciting time to be in telecoms, especially in the disruptive side of the telecommunications space.
Okay. So if these networks start to get rolled out in South Africa, who do you think is going to be doing it? Is it going to be your small ISPs? Do you see the big mobile operators taking an interest in this technology, especially since they are struggling to get access to additional exclusive use spectrum? Do you expect Vodacom, MTN, companies like that to look at white spaces and see it as an option for the continuing to deliver their services, particularly in meeting their rural rollout mandates?
There's no reason why they shouldn't. I suspect there are reasons why the big mobile operators won't, simply because the technology, it's quite new. It's been proven in a lot of trials, mm-hmm. but it's pretty bleeding edge. It's not what you'd call sort of carrier grade technology. Mm-hmm. It is going to be a best effort type of service, which means that you need to be pitching it at a market that understands that they're paying a very small amount of money, but it's a best effort service. So I'm not sure if it's really in the DNA of the mobile operators to roll out that kind of network. My guess is it will be more like the WAPA type of companies, the wireless ISPs,
right,
who have so far been rolling out networks based on point-to-multipoint Wi-Fi. So they're very used to this environment where it's you have to build into your network a lot of baling wire and chewing gum. Because it is not a $500,000 piece of kit; it's a $600 piece of kit. And also, the way of thinking about rolling out the networks will be very different. Because if you're providing service to an underserviced community, it really needs to be an uncapped service. Mm-hmm. The model of paying 20 or 50 or 60 or 100 rand a month for your LTE data bundle, it's incredibly limiting for people wanting to use the internet. It means that you can only very quickly use it, and then your data runs out, and then you can't communicate anymore. So you were sending your WhatsApp messages, and then your data ran out, and now you're completely cut off. To really change the way people view using the internet and using it for communication, for research, for studying, for socializing, it really needs to be an uncapped type of service. And I think that's much more in the thought space of the wireless ISP type of industry, where typically they fundamentally build their business around sort of an uncapped type of service.
Okay. So how will this work in practice in the last mile if the service is rolled out to, say, an area in rural KwaZulu-Natal? How will I, as an end user, access the service? Will I have to go to an area where there's a Wi-Fi hotspot that connects to this TV White Spaces network? Or is there a possibility that in future my cell phone will be able to pick up the signals?
To put my cynical hat on, I'd say that there's very little chance that your cell phone will one day will work with this network, simply because the people that build chipsets for mobile phones are very closely allied with the mobile operators, and this will be hugely disruptive to the mobile wireless space. That being said, I was at the Dynamic Spectrum Alliance Global Summit in Ghana about 3 years ago now, and there were a couple of the big chipset manufacturers who are looking at delivering chipsets in mobile phone type form factors. So technically, it's entirely possible. Commercially, would the mobile phone handset makers want to bring this kind of disruptive technology to market? It's a bit of an unknown. Most likely, it will be a mixture of Wi-Fi for very local access, mm-hmm. and then TV white space for backhaul. Just because Wi-Fi is very cheap. There's already Wi-Fi access in your phone, in your tablet, in your laptop. And the TV white space networks, it's a lot of spectrum, but it's not an infinite amount of spectrum. So it would make sense to aggregate links in the TV white space bands, simply to increase the efficiency of the available channels.
Okay. Roger, I'm aware of at least two separate trials that have been conducted in South Africa. I think one was in Limpopo and the other one was in Cape Town. I think the Limpopo one enjoyed backing from Microsoft and others, and the Cape Town one from Google and others.
Yes.
What did those trials show? They were amongst the first in the world, weren't they?
They were. They were largely the technical work was done by CSIR Morocco. With, as you say, support from Google in Cape Town and Microsoft in Limpopo. Fundamentally, the trials were meant to show that the fundamental principle of the technology worked, that you could set up broadband links for users that wouldn't interfere with TV station users. And all of these trials were successful in showing that the technology fundamentally worked. And that's why, to an extent, no one's been doing any more trials, because it's been done around the world in a number of places in very deep rural like Limpopo, in very deep or very dense urban like Cape Town, but also in Singapore, in Accra, in a number of countries. So the technology has been proven. The trials showed that the propagation models would work in terms of predicting where somebody should or should not be able to allocate an available channel. And they actually set up the links for various schools and hospitals. And the users of the broadband links were completely happy with how it worked. The links were reliable. They had the throughput that they were promised. And that's why we've reached the point where nobody's interested in doing trials anymore. We now want to move to commercial rollouts. And that's where I think the state-owned enterprises like Centec, like Transnet, could potentially play a huge role, because they have a mandate, in a sense, to build the economy, to in some cases to provide services to underserviced areas, and they have the most brilliant high sites. And often the biggest problem in trying to roll out a network is, do you have access to that site which has got power, it's high, it's secure? And Transnet and Centec independently have got awesome high sites, and a lot of these are connected into a fiber infrastructure. So that allows you to leapfrog a lot of the issues that a low-cost network rollout would have. And what we need to do now is to basically go, the regulations are published. They are state-owned enterprises who have got phenomenal resources that they could bring to bear. It's now just a matter of putting in some kit and starting to actually deploy commercial services.
Okay. When can we expect the first commercial services? Are companies talking about doing it already? Have any applications been sent to ICASA to launch services?
Not to my knowledge. There is a project that I've been working on, which unfortunately is confidential for the moment, mm-hmm. Where we're hoping to be able to demonstrate a commercial pilot, which could then be used as a template for a more national rollout. But that was done over the last 6 months or so, before the regulations were published. Now that the regulations are published, it changes the nature of those kind of investigations a bit, because now you no longer have that risk factor of we build it and then we can't actually commercialize it because there's no regulatory environment. There is a bit of a stumbling block in terms of the regulation, is that I mentioned at the beginning that the fundamental requirement is that the white space base station device has to talk to a geolocation database to be assigned a particular channel that it's allowed to use. And the regulations that ICASA published allow for a primary geolocation database, and they would then have to essentially certify and authorize that operator, and that operator is not yet in place of that primary geolocation database. So would it be operated by ICASA? Would it be operated by one of the industry associations on behalf of ICASA, with maybe a private sector organization doing the operationalization? That's still to be done. And there's no obvious process to apply for the ability to be that operator. But because this is a relatively new technology, and ICASA is, I think, trying to be progressive and trying to be flexible, I think it's just a matter of somebody going to them with a viable business case to say, we would be able to provide the service. We have this underlying technology. We have the ability to support the users of the technology, which would ultimately be small network operators. So if in realistic terms, probably 6 months to a year. I wouldn't say less than 6 months, but I wouldn't say more than a year to start seeing commercial operations.
Okay.
Because as I said, the cost is very low. The barrier to entry is very low. It simply requires somebody with a little bit of boldness to go out there and start putting up kit.
Just coming back to the database, who in your opinion should be running it? Should it be the regulator or should it be an industry run thing?
So one of the ideas I've been kicking around and chatting to some people about is someone like WAPA, which is the Industry Association for the Wireless ISPs, because they have experience of working with operators in a light licensed or a license exempt space, where you have to do a lot of self-policing. The Spectrum cop isn't going to come bang on your door if you start doing something wrong. The industry itself has to be cooperative. So someone like a WAPA or an ISPA might be well placed to do it. Or potentially maybe a large telecoms operator that doesn't have a specific axe to grind in the broadband wireless space. So somebody that potentially provides services but doesn't operate the infrastructure, so there's not a conflict of interest between being the fox and the hen. It's probably not a very difficult task. So in the UK, there's a number of white space database operators, ranging from Nominet to in fact the CSIR. They've got a license to operate a database, although as far as I know, they don't have a commercial operation in place. It's not massively difficult to do. The resources you require aren't massively sort of expensive. It just requires experience in working with operators, in running a support desk, in ensuring that all of the regulatory requirements are met in terms of being able to provide the service reliably, in terms of making sure that all the data is up to date, that if there are complaints, that you have a mechanism to deal with it. It's really not rocket science to operate this Spectrum database.
Okay. Let's talk about the regulations. We've touched on it several times during this discussion already. They were a long time in the making, but they're here now. What do they say exactly? What important things do they say? And what should the industry be aware of in them?
So I think the regulations, they're quite well written. I think ICASA took a lot of its lead from Ofcom in the UK. Mm-hmm. And they're relatively light in the sense that they are quite specific about the technical boundaries. So you may not kind of leak outside your band more than a certain amount. You may not exceed a certain amount of power from your transmissions. But apart from that, they're relatively light. So which is a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing in the sense that it means that people can get into the space quite quickly and start to actually do real things. It's bad in the sense that the there is no protection for a secondary operator. So that might vary from regime to regime, but essentially it means that it's a little bit like the wireless ISP space. If there's an operator that's either acting like a cowboy or is technically inept and has misconfigured the equipment, or there's an equipment fault, that there's very little recourse for the secondary operators. But as the wireless ISPs have shown, it's possible to successfully run businesses and provide decent services even in that very light license space. The regulations themselves, they basically describe two different types of devices. They describe a static device and a nomadic device. So a nomadic device would be something that you can carry around with you. It wouldn't necessarily be like a mobile phone that you'd put in your pocket, but it could be a thing that you kind of hook on the wall outside where you're currently working from. And then a static device is something that's got a fixed location where its location is known to the white space, the master white space device. What you would need to be able to do to roll out these devices, they just need to be type approved. And again, the type approval is relatively straightforward. Basically, you need to take your devices to ICASA with certificates from an ICASA-recognized laboratory or testing facility to say that it meets the technical requirements in terms of out-of-band emissions and maximum power and so on. And once it's type approved, you can once you've demonstrated that it can talk to the geolocation databases, and then it can be given command and control instructions. After that, you pretty much off you go and set up your network.
Are there any limits to the number of such networks you can operate within a geographic area?
Not in the regulations, no.
Technically?
Technically, it basically comes down to the number of available bands. Mm-hmm. So if you've got 8 megahertz bands, you've got, 470 to 694... 224 divided by 8 brackets, you've got roughly 28 bands, which potentially means a maximum of 28 operators in that particular geographic area. Because 30 megabits per second these days is not a huge amount of data, you'd probably find that the operators would want to carve out 3, 4, 5 channels. So you'd probably technically not be able to realistically have more than 3 or 4 operators in a particular geographic area. But the nature of telecoms is typically that you'd get a whole bunch of people rolling out. After a while, only 2 or 3 would be able to survive because they were able to manage to build a successful and profitable business. So rule of thumb, you'd probably say no more than 3 to 5 in a particular area.
Okay. So just coming back to these regulations, you need type approval for the equipment you use. If you're a big mobile operator, you obviously have to get a spectrum license, and that often costs a heck of a lot of money, especially if it goes to an auction. In these regulations, is there anything about spectrum licenses? Do you need any specific licenses to be able to roll out this technology?
No. So that's why it's quite similar to the wireless ISP space in the Wi-Fi bands, is that the primary users, which is the TV stations, they pay for a license.
Yeah.
The secondary users don't pay for a license effectively, but they don't enjoy any protection. So the only real cost is obviously the operator would have to have some kind of license to operate a communications network. Mm-hmm. So either a class license or an individual license, like an ECNS license, but you don't need a spectrum license per se. So you're not paying those monthly fees for that spectrum, which is partly why it's so attractive to startup operations in underserviced areas.
Okay, and massively reduces the barriers to entry, and potentially also massively increases the competition to the incumbent players.
Exactly. So I think the mobile operators have probably got mixed feelings about this set of regulations being published, because obviously their business models are now more and more focused on data rather than voice. Mm-hmm. Now that the urban areas are relatively saturated. There is still growth in the rural areas, but only if they can reduce the costs from sort of hundreds of rands per month to tens of rands per month. There was some interesting data that was looking at the size of the markets and how much the average consumer might pay. And it starts at the top, sort of the wealthier people. So you call it the first billion people on Earth. They spend something around $200 per month for communications, whether that's mobile phone or fiber or whatever it is. When you get to the third billion, that $200 has already dropped to $20-odd. So now you're talking about the first almost half of the world is already able to spend more money than many people in our rural areas can spend. When you get to the seventh billion slice of people around the world, they've only got $2.25 to spend per month. So anything that can provide a service where you can give somebody a usable internet service at the $2 mark is an entire game changer, because it means that there's 2 or 3 billion people around the world that previously would never have been able to afford a decent internet service who now could. And the mobile operators, they're probably very interested in those 2 or 3 billion people, but the nature of their technology and their businesses is extremely expensive. It's unlikely they'd ever be able to provide services at a cost point that could reach those people.
Okay, we've seen many big, especially US tech companies, looking at different technologies to try and bridge the so-called digital divide and connect the next billion people. Google had that flying balloon project. Facebook was putting up a satellite, but Elon Musk, I think, blew it up on the launch pad. So they're looking at different
aeroplanes. Exactly. The idea of them quite out
there. TV white spaces, do you think that this is the technology that is going to connect those next couple of billion people?
It is one of the technologies, if I can be a little bit weaselly. It does solve a number of the cost problems in terms of rolling out the middle mile. Mm-hmm. It still does have its own problems in the sense that you need to get power to your base stations. Okay, great, you can solar power them, but as soon as you start putting up solar cells, then they become targets for theft. So I guess that the one advantage of balloons floating around the stratosphere or very small low Earth orbit satellites is that once your kit is up there, at least you don't have to worry about it being stolen. but if the TV white space kit is low cost, you could potentially drop it in a big steel box and bolt it to the top of a mountain and form a mesh network in an underserviced area. So yes, it might be less sexy than a satellite or a stratospheric balloon, but it'll probably be more practical to roll out. So, short answer to the question is TV white space has the promise of being probably the most promising disruptor to the current economics of rolling out networks.
Okay. We heard about WiMAX, 10 years ago, and it was also touted as this thing that's going to solve the connectivity problem. Is there a risk at TV white spaces as the next WiMAX?
Yes and no. I'd say mostly no, because the problem with WiMAX wasn't that the technology was fundamentally flawed. It was that there wasn't enough industry buy-in by a big enough ecosystem to deploy it to a scale that would start driving down the costs. So a little bit like the iBurst technology that we all remember well, mm-hmm. is that the technology itself wasn't bad, but a mixture of corporate politics, timing, bad luck, whatever it might be, meant that the costs just never reached a viable cost point. Also, one of the issues with WiMAX is that you would fundamentally need a device that spoke WiMAX, mm-hmm. and that never really happened. Mm-hmm. which is why a bit of a hybrid model of Wi-Fi plus TV white space makes a lot more sense, because you don't want to be in a position where you're at the mercy of the cell phone manufacturers or the tablet manufacturers to allow the end users to connect. So I think the promise of WiMAX was that it would allow you to get very high speeds directly to you as the end consumer. I think a mistake with the TV white space industry might be to try to talk directly to consumers rather than to address the clear and known problem, which is the middle mile problem.
Okay. Roger, are you aware of any commercial deployments of TV white space technology anywhere in the world yet?
I suppose the one that it's well known, but people have forgotten about it because it's worked quite well, is Mawingu Wireless in Kenya. Mm-hmm. So that was a partnership which included a local company called Indigo Telecoms, who were also very involved in the Limpopo trial. And this was done 5-7 years ago even. And it's basically been kind of ticking away outside of Nairobi for years now, and providing a perfectly acceptable service to people in this area. There's also some commercial rollouts in the US. So this is particularly this company Carlson's Backyard, where they're connecting up kind of rural communities. And those have also been operating for a couple of years successfully, although a little bit under the radar because they haven't really reached a scale where they attract the attention of anybody but people specifically involved in the TV white space industry, or the nascent TV white space industry.
Roger, before I let you go, I'm going to ask you to look into your crystal ball. Tell us what you think the TV white spaces industry is going to look like in South Africa 5 years from now. How many operators are we going to have? How many people are going to be connected using this technology?
I would say there will be millions of people connected, simply because from a practical point of view, the technology makes so much sense. Anything that connects people in the sort of 600 to 800 megahertz range is fundamentally cheaper than most of the mobile phone technologies, which mostly sit in the sort of 1.8, 2.4, 3 gigahertz range. Because it's light licensed, it's very efficient use of available spectrum. It means that the economics behind it fundamentally makes sense. It doesn't require a massive injection of capital and almost a locked-in market to be able to generate a return for the original investors. You can go from a startup to a medium-sized, successful white space operator within a year or two. It doesn't take 5 or 10 years to get a reasonable ROI. And because the ability to roll out a small local Wi-Fi network for a community is—it's now almost—it arrives in a box. You set it up, you turn it on, and it kind of self-configures to a certain extent. There's a number of companies on the back end who can provide the services in terms of billing and support. The technical requirements and the time that you actually need to be running the network has now become practical for a one-man band to set up a network in Mthatha or in Vosloorus or pick a small town. So the economies of rolling out a local access network are really, really favorable. The technical and the economies of rolling out a white-space middle-mile network are really, really favorable. I would imagine that in 5 years' time, it will be a core part of the mix of technologies that provide broadband.
Just listening to
probably your initially in urban areas, but then later in urban areas. I mean, there's no reason why this technology doesn't work in urban areas.
Just listening to what you said there, Roger, it really sounds like this technology has the potential to upend the economics of the telecommunications industry. I mean, historically, you've needed very deep pockets. You had to raise billions in capital in order to be able to roll out a network. We're almost going in completely the opposite direction here, in that a one-man band can start a telecoms network.
Absolutely. And a lot of that is, if you think of the cloud model, where you've got access to an enormous amount of technology sitting in a data center run by Amazon or Microsoft or Google, whomever. But you can only kind of carve off the little bit that you need right now. Telecoms is moving to a similar place where you don't need to roll out this massive national macro network to do something useful. Whereas in the old days, to be a mobile operator, you had to roll out this massive national network, because if I picked up my phone in Joburg and I couldn't make a call, then it wasn't fit for purpose. But because you can now carve out just a small amount of a market using a technology that's completely open to almost any user. So my Wi-Fi device can connect to any Wi-Fi network as long as I've got some kind of authentication on the network. And that can now be provided through a cloud service where I connect to network A using an aggregator in the background, even though I'm a customer of network B. So the economics are fundamentally different now. You don't need that multi-billion dollar investment in a macro network. You can start off small and provide a service to a customer that they can use with you, but they could potentially use it with other operators in other places, because Wi-Fi is an open standard. The authentication mechanisms are open standards. This is probably quite frightening to the network operators of the big mobile networks, because the barrier to entry has dropped. The ability to target a small community and profitably run a business means that they've got competitors who are two or three people today, but could potentially be very substantial in 5 or 10 years' time. The big network operators have got an interesting next decade, because the last two decades they've made trillions of dollars, and now they're going to need to rethink how they operate their businesses, because the cost base that they have is incredible. Are they going to get frozen out by smaller, more nimble competitors who've got a fraction of the cost base?
Fascinating stuff, Roger. I think that could be the subject of an entirely different discussion, the commodification
what
of the
future of a mobile operator,
the future of the telecommunications industry.
But obviously they've got their place, because something like 5G type of technologies, we're looking at sort of gigabits per second data rates, that is still going to be phenomenally expensive technology to roll out. So there is a place for them to move to. The question is, will they want to give up the ground in the space that TV white spaces could target?
Excellent, Roger. This has been a fascinating discussion. Roger Hislop is Senior Research Engineer at Internet Solutions. Thank you so much for talking to Tech Central today.
Thank you very much, Duncan.